Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, a Stanford Medical and Business School professor, a Forbes contributor and best-selling author of the book Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong.
And I am Jeremy Corr, host of the New Books in Medicine podcast. American healthcare is broken. Across the United States, there are over 200,000 patient deaths from medical error every year, growing physician burnout, outdated technology, and inconvenient and delayed care for patients. And on top of all of this, skyrocketing drug prices and increasingly unaffordable out-of-pocket patient expenses. For decades, our nation's political and medical leaders have talked about fixing the American healthcare system, and yet the problems are now greater than in the past.
Every other industry that is inefficient and ineffective has experienced disruption. Healthcare will be no different. The question is whether the solutions will come from inside the healthcare system or be imposed on it. We'd like to invite you to listen to our new podcast, Fixing Healthcare with Dr. Robert Pearl and Jeremy Corr. Each episode will feature one of the top leaders and innovative thinkers in healthcare today. The show's format is simple. The guests will present a roadmap for fixing American healthcare's biggest problems. And from there, Jeremy and I will scrutinize the plan and help listeners separate fixes that have the potential to succeed from simply the hype.
Our goal is that everyone from healthcare consumers to political and medical leaders will find value in the discussions on our show. You may not agree with the different solutions offered, but you will never again conclude that nothing can be done. We hope you will join us. Please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast software. For more information, visit our website at www.fixinghealthcarepodcast.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Medicine. I am your host, Jeremy Corr. Today, we will be talking to Dorothy H. Crawford. Dorothy is an emeritus professor of microbiology at the University of Edinburgh, a fellow of the Royal Society of Edinburgh, and a fellow of the Academy of Medical Sciences. She is here today to talk about her book, Deadly Companions, How Microbes Shaped Our History. Dorothy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Yes, sure. I'm a microbiologist, but I specialise in viruses, and I had the chair of medical microbiology at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine until 1997, when I moved to Edinburgh to take the chair of the same name. I then became the assistant principal for public understanding of medicine at the University of Edinburgh, and I held that until 2012, when I retired. I now live on a small holding in the west coast of Scotland. I look after animals, I grow vegetables, and I write popular science books and articles. Overall, I've written 8 popular science books, mostly about viruses. And presently, I'm writing a science column for the local newspaper.
What inspired you to write Deadly Companions?
Well, I actually wrote it 10 years ago and updated it last year as part of Oxford University Press Landmark Science series. So I've always been fascinated by the interaction between microbes and man. And because I study them, I don't see them always as an enemy. You know, I'm interested in how they interact with us and also how that interaction has changed over the centuries. and how microbes might have affected world history. So it sounds like a large task, but I really enjoyed writing it, actually. There's not much out there. You have to sort of relate it between different publications because there's not much out there that relates the two together.
Let's give our listeners a bit of foundation for the rest of the conversation. Can you please define the term microbe as it's used in your book?
Yes, I use the term microbe to mean any microscopic organism. So mainly I'm talking about protozoa, bacteria, archaea, and viruses. Those would be the main ones.
Can you talk about how microbial life began and how it evolved?
Yeah, sure. Well, life on Earth appeared about 4 billion years ago, when the Earth had cooled sufficiently for there to be water rather than water vapor around. And at first, or for a long time, it was just single-celled organisms, rather similar to today's archaea. And these are also called extremophiles because they live in the most hostile environment that you can find. So you find them today in acid lakes and salt marshes and at the bottom of ocean trenches where hot vents spew out boiling water or hotter than boiling water and under the polar ice caps. And these microbes had the world all to themselves for about 3 billion years. So not surprisingly, they have evolved to occupy every niche. There was no oxygen available at the time, so they used chemicals such as sulfur, nitrogen, and iron to generate energy. And it's only after all that time that multicellular organisms evolved, once oxygen was available, to make respiration much more efficient.
Can you talk about the different ways that various microbes spread?
Yes, well, I mean, microbes have evolved to spread in every conceivable way to reach a susceptible host. Obviously, for them, this is their lifeline. If they leave one host because the immunity is building up and can't find another host, then they die. And if that happens to all the microbes in that particular species, then that's it, died out. I usually say that if you can think of a way that a microbe might spread, then it will have already thought of it. So there are the obvious methods of transport, like direct contact between hosts, for example, indirect contact via infected objects, through the air is a very efficient way of spreading long distances, or in water, or spread by a vector like a mosquito. But they also can spread from mother to unborn child through the blood and the placenta, and they're extremely up to date by utilizing blood transfusion, organ transplant, contaminated needles, and contaminated surgical instruments. So, as I say, they are extremely efficient at moving from one host to another.
What is an epidemic and what causes them to strike?
Well, an epidemic is defined rather vaguely, I suppose, as a large-scale increase in a particular disease in a specific location. So these generally occur when a microbe, for example, Ebola recently, is introduced to a naive or a susceptible community. And it can then rip right through the community, infecting people, until almost everybody is either recovered and are immune to further attack or has died of the disease. And then, obviously, the epidemic falls off and the microbe moves somewhere else for a while.
So then what's the difference between an epidemic and a pandemic?
Well, it's really a case of size. An epidemic is, as I said, a large-scale increase in a particular disease in a particular location. A pandemic is when you get an increase on a worldwide scale. So the epidemic has to be going on two continents at the same time to call it a pandemic. So we get pandemics of flu when they literally sweep around the world.
Can you please explain host resistance for our listeners?
Yes, well, host resistance just means a person who is resistant to an infectious microbe. And this occurs either when somebody has been infected before and therefore develops immunity to further infection, or it may be due to genetic resistance. And genetic resistance develops in a community slowly over generations, and in a community that's constantly battling with a lethal microbe, such as malaria or plague, for example. So during an epidemic of these fairly lethal organisms, the microbes kill those that have the weakest resistance because they have high death rates, these diseases, leaving the survivors to reproduce. So over centuries, those with the most resistance thrive, and in the end, the whole community becomes less susceptible. A good example, if you'd like one, is sickle cell anemia, which is an inherited mutation of red blood cells that cause them to be misshapen, and they carry oxygen poorly. And this is a disease that occurs in Africa, genetic disease. It's fatal in homozygotes, that is, people who get the gene from both parents, if untreated. But in homozygous can survive. Heterozygous people can survive. They're the people who get one gene and have one normal gene. So such a mutation would have died out ages ago if this particular one didn't protect against death from malaria. So malaria parasites find it hard to infect these sickled red cells, and that's part of their life cycle. And so the mutation has actually reached very high levels in parts of Africa where malaria has been around for a very long time.
Can you please talk a bit about early hunter-gatherer humans and microbes, specifically touching on malaria and sleeping sickness?
Our hunter-gatherer ancestors evolved in Africa about 150,000 years ago. They were nomads, living in small groups or bands of about 30 to 50 people or so, generally a few extended families. And they basically moved from place to place according to the seasons, often following herds of cattle or crop cycles, and surviving by hunting and fishing and gathering edible plants. And so that may sound an idyllic lifestyle, but in fact their life expectancy was only around 25 to 30 years. So the question that interested me was, what microbes infected them, and did they generally die of infectious diseases? Unfortunately, very few infectious agents leave any trace, at least on the skeletons that have been found, and so it's difficult to answer these questions. But we do know that hunter-gatherers didn't suffer from the classical acute childhood infections that were epidemic among us until very recently, when immunization has sort of dealt with them. Things like measles, mumps, and rubella, I'm talking about, the classic childhood illnesses. And we know that they didn't suffer from these because there just weren't enough people in their band, in the isolated bands, to sustain such infections. I mean, people have looked at modern hunter-gatherer bands and found that if, for example, measles does get introduced into them from the outside, it certainly rips through them all because they've got no immunity and no genetic resistance. But once the outbreak has finished, the measles virus has nowhere to go, and so it dies out, and it would have to be introduced to them again for them to suffer again. So you were suggesting I told you about malaria for a start. This has certainly been around in Africa for thousands of years, and it's not absolutely clear whether the hunter-gatherers suffered from it or not. But we do know now that the mosquitoes that transmit the parasite efficiently, they're called Anopheles gambiae, have only evolved during the agricultural era. And so most people think that malaria probably did infect hunter-gatherers occasionally, but that it probably didn't really affect the life of the band as a whole. It's also true that there are four types of malaria that infect humans, and two of them can establish a chronic infection, which stays in the body for the lifetime of the person and gives bouts of fever, and also makes the person extremely lethargic. So because these don't have to constantly travel from one person to another, it's thought that hunter-gatherers may have suffered from these touches of malaria. And certainly if they did, then having a person with chronic malaria, with lethargy, and really being very much indisposed to the hunter-gatherer lifestyle could have been a problem for the bands. On the other hand, sleeping sickness, which you also mentioned, was almost certainly a major problem for them. This is also a protozoa caused by the trypanosome, and its natural target is large game, wild game animals in Africa. So almost all large game animals are infected with this trypanosome, and it causes them no problem at all. It's spread between them by the tsetse fly, and it just seems to be a relationship that is advantageous to the tsetse fly and no problem to the large game. However, if the microbe spreads to humans, then it causes a fatal encephalitis. There are two different sorts of sleeping sickness that can affect human. One is acute, in which case the encephalitis would come on very rapidly and the person would die, or there's a chronic phase. And again, like malaria, this could have caused the bands a lot of problems because it was difficult, obviously, for them moving from place to place to be able to accommodate chronically sick individuals. It seems that people get sleeping sickness if they get bitten by a tsetse fly that is carrying it. And in order to do that, you have to be in fairly close contact with large game animals because tsetse flies don't fly far from these animals that they infect. So following that line of thought, it would mostly be the hunters of large game in the hunter-gatherer bands who got infected, and they would of course be the fit young males, members who were really required for the band to survive. So historians think that the loss of, you know, two or three vital hunters from the band would be a death sentence for it. And in fact, some of them even suggest that the trypanosome might have initiated man's exodus from Africa to cooler and perhaps healthier areas, which occurred some 50 to 100,000 years ago.
Let's talk a bit about that. Humans spread across the planet and eventually underwent a shift from a nomadic to a sedentary farming lifestyle. This marked a turning point for human history, but also heralded a new era for microbes. Can you please talk about this for our listeners?
Humans abandoned, when they abandoned the hunter-gatherer lifestyle in favor of fixed dwellings, which first occurred in Mesopotamia about 10 to 12,000 years ago, it was the beginning of the agricultural revolution, and microbes had an absolute field day. It was initially a very unhealthy period for our ancestors, for several reasons, in fact. The first one is that they were now living in small, crowded, dirty hovels, so microbes found it much easier to pass from one person to another, and those that pass, that spread by close contact, like, for example, TB and leprosy, certainly increased a lot in this early farming period. Secondly, hunter-gatherers were always moving from one place to another and leaving all their waste materials behind. But now, of course, living in a fixed permanent dwellings, their waste materials accumulated in and around the dwellings, so encouraging transmission of various fecal-borne organisms, particularly, I think, intestinal worms, became a real problem at that stage. Another problem was that instead of collecting their food and water daily as they went about, they now stored their food and water in their dirty hovels, and this allowed microbes that spread in food or water an opportunity to flourish. And finally, and most importantly, I think, our ancestors now lived in very close proximity to the newly domesticated animals. They often shared dwellings with them, and they certainly had very close contact with them, and perhaps particularly sick animals. So microbes that had always lived on these animals now took the opportunity to jump to humans. And these were the emerging infections, obviously, of the farming era. And what they are now is our classical childhood illnesses. So things like smallpox, mumps, measles, flu, all these things, jumped from animals to humans during this early farming period. It's interesting that recently, now that the genomes of these microbes have been sequenced, we can see where they came from. And so smallpox, for example, is most closely related to camel and gerbil pox viruses. So it seems that the ancient relative of those viruses must have jumped from two humans, camels and gerbils, around about the same time. And similarly with measles, if the genome of measles is most similar to the Rinderpest virus, which infects cattle, and also to the canine distemper virus infecting dogs. So again, you can imagine that these animals and humans were coming into close contact, and so now the viruses must have jumped between them, and now they share these viruses.
Can you please talk a bit about some of the ancient plagues, such as the Plague of Athens and the Justinian Plague, and their impact on history?
The first plagues to be recorded in sufficient detail for us to hazard a guess as to what caused them. Well, the first one was actually the Plague of Athens, which occurred in 430 BC. This is interesting. It occurred during the Peloponnesian Wars, when Sparta and Athens were fighting each other. They'd been fighting for more than 20 years, I think. And on this particular occasion, the Spartan infantry were attacking Athens, and Pericles, who was the ruler of Athens at the time, decided to fortify the city, not to counterattack, but to fortify the city, leaving access only via the sea port of Piraeus, and to sit out the siege until the Spartans surrendered. But it didn't quite work out like that, because everybody from the surrounding countryside crowded into Athens, and it became an incredibly crowded and unhealthy place to be. And eventually, not surprisingly, an epidemic struck suddenly and raged for 4 years, killing 25% of the population, including Pericles himself. Thucydides did list the symptoms, but historians are really divided as to what was the cause of this. I think most think it was probably smallpox, but a few historians favour measles or typhoid. But whatever it was instrumental in the defeat of the Athenians, and that heralded the end of the Greek Empire. The other one I could find information about was the Antonine Plague, which hit the Roman Empire in 166 AD, when Marcus Aurelius Antonius was the emperor. This is interesting. It probably began in Seleucia, which is a city on the river Tigris, where troops had been sent to quell an uprising. It seemed they, when it began, they made their way back to Rome and carried the plague with them. And they believed that this was a punishment for the soldiers who sacked the temple in the city, the Temple of Apollo, and opened a sealed tomb. And they think that evil spirits came out of the tomb and caused this in retribution. So it's described as a fever plague by Galen of Bergamon, who was the physician around at the time, and it was almost certainly smallpox. I said that the troops had brought it back to Rome, where it killed at its height 5,000 a day. But from there, it was carried along all the trade routes that the Romans had established all over the empire and on, indeed, into India and China. It lasted for several decades, and there was an enormous loss of manpower, which led to a decline in the empire for the next 100 years or so, merely because they just didn't have the manpower to form their army, to man their agriculture, to do the trading and everything. The Justinian Plague, yes. This also hit the Roman Empire, but this time in 542 AD, and lasted on and off for 200 years. it was estimated to kill 100 million overall, and probably spelt the end of the empire, in fact. This is thought to be the first pandemic of bubonic plague caused by the bacterium Yersinia pestis, but of course that wasn't known at the time. It then, after 200 years, it disappeared from Europe for 600 years before emerging again as the Black Death in 1346. So absolutely massive spread. And of course, I mean, the Romans had so many trade routes and everything all over their empire that, you know, they're more or less asking for microbes to be carried along them by the constant procession of traders and things, and armies, of course.
So what is probably the most well-known pandemic in history is that of the Black Death in the Middle Ages, which was the second bubonic plague pandemic in recorded history. Can you please talk about the Black Death for our listeners?
Sure. The Black Death, as I've just said, began in 1346. It spread west from Mongolia, reaching the port of Kaffa on the Black Sea in 1347. And this was when it was first sort of noticed by Europeans, if you like, because Kaffa was a Genoese trading post on the Black Sea, and they were fighting the Mongols at the time. And when this plague arrived, the Italians there hurriedly jumped into their galleys and sailed for home. So they first landed in Sicily, where they carried the plague with them, and they were very unwelcome guests. In the end, they were thrown out, and so they carried on and sailed to Genoa and to Venice, and initiating an epidemic of the plague at each stop. And from these centres, the plague spread all over Europe, Asia, and North Africa, again following trade routes in from the ports that it arrived at. The microbe reached the south coast of Britain in 1348 and travelled north, again along trade routes, covering the whole length of the country in about 500 days. It killed about a third of the population, between a half and a third, in fact, and worldwide that amounted to about 25 million people. It finally abated in Europe in 1353, but outbreaks continued for about 300 years, ending with the Great Plague of London in 1665-6. And obviously, like the Justinian Plague, there was a huge loss of manpower, and the population didn't actually recover for 300 years. And so it's thought that the changes that occurred probably led to the breakup of the feudal system in Britain anyway, and the beginning of the sort of modern era. Of course, at the time, no one knew the cause. There were all sorts of theories. But, and this was all worked out in the third pandemic, which began in the 1800s. But in fact, I mean, it is interesting. I don't know if you want me to talk about how it is spread.
Yes, that'd be great.
Okay. Well, it's caused by a bacterium called Yersinia pestis. And this bacteria naturally infects rodents. And it's spread between them by their fleas. And rodents live in enormous sort of underground cities. And many rodents, but not all, are immune. They don't get any disease with this Yersinia pestis. It just infects them and their fleas pass it from one rodent to another. But sometimes there are rodents that are susceptible, particularly rats. And sometimes it's sort of, particularly when there's been a population explosion among rodents, they mix with other types. They come out of their burrows and mix with other types of rodents while looking for food. And if it infects a susceptible kind of rodent, let's say rats, because that's what's normally said, then they die very rapidly of the disease. The fleas then get hungry and jump off the rat, and if they jump onto humans and they're carrying the microbe, then that's how humans get infected. So the plague in humans is actually cannot be passed from one human to another. It has to come from an infected rat flea. And so once it gets into the population, because rats were so common in those days and particularly travelled around the world in boats and then followed trade routes inland were following the traders, this is how the microbes spread so widely.
What was the microbial impact of European exploration and colonization into the Americas?
Well, it was enormous. When Europeans discovered the New World, which was at the end of the 15th century, the Americas had been isolated since the end of the Ice Age, some 10,000 years before. By the time the Europeans got there, there were around 100 million Native Americans living mostly, a lot of them in two thriving communities, the Incas in Peru and the Aztec in Mexico. The Europeans were really bounty hunters, and it was absolutely catastrophic for these empires, not only because they were looking for gold and other things, but also because of the microbes that they brought with them. So really, it was like a reenaction of the early agricultural stage of the hunt, you know, when the hunter-gatherers became farmers and settled down and got all the childhood infectious diseases for the first time, like measles, smallpox, mumps, rubella. That is exactly what happened in the Americas. The Aztecs and the Incas had never experienced anything like this before. They had no resistance, and they just really dropped like flies. Terrible, terrible disaster it was. So the population dropped by about 90% over the next 120 years, with the loss of whole tribes of Native Americans. And one example I found was that in Hispaniola, which is where Columbus actually arrived in America, now Haiti, the population of 8 million when he arrived, and not one remained 40 years later. So no wonder the Aztecs and the Incas were conquered so easily. And this same scenario was played out in other countries as well, that the Europeans conquered, for example, Australia. The same thing happened to the native Australians there, the Aborigines, and many of the isolated islands that they arrived at on their boats and things. So really fairly disastrous, I would say.
Can you talk a bit about the potato blight in Ireland and its effects?
Yeah, I included this in the book to illustrate that even microbes that don't infect us directly can have a devastating effect on us. And in this occasion, it's because they infected and wiped out a very, very important food source. The potato blight is one of the most pathogenic of plant infections. It can kill a whole field of previously healthy plants within days under the right conditions. It hit Europe. Well, the potato was imported, obviously, at the time when the Europeans first went to South America. They brought back the potato, and it became extremely popular over the years. And the potato blight, it seems, came from the same South American source and was imported into Europe and seen there for the first time in the 1840s. It reached Britain in 1845, and it raged again in 1846 and again in 1848. The Irish cottiers were the worst hit for several reasons. First of all, because of their poverty. They were living from hand to mouth anyway. They owned no land. They were really bottom of the pile, if you like. They owned no land of their own. They were beholden to their landlords, and they simply had no reserves when this happened. They had at the time, in the 1800s, their population was rapidly increasing. They had very large families, and they had become dependent on potatoes as a dietary staple. I mean, the potato really, in Ireland particularly, replaced grain crops because it was so much more productive, and because I found it rather surprising to learn that the potato plus a little bit of milk is enough in a diet to prevent you from getting any vitamin deficiencies or anything. So that's actually all they needed, and that was in the end all they had. And the final thing is that, of course, the climate in Ireland is very damp, and that is ideal for the blight to strike. So the result was absolutely horrific. I mean, 4.5 million faced starvation, of which over a million died and 1.3 million emigrated. So a really major, major event for Ireland and for the UK, in fact.
What did people throughout history think caused diseases? I know earlier we kind of touched on religious punishment and things like that. Can you talk a bit about the discovery of microbes and some of the major milestones that got us to our present level of understanding?
Yeah, sure. From the sort of Middle Ages onwards, most people believed in a miasma theory, which attributed epidemics to foul smells and noxious vapors emanating from swamps and rotting material. So when an epidemic came along, the rich, of course, would move away and go to healthier places and avoid an epidemic if they could. But the poor were obviously not able to do that. This miasma theory was held until somewhere around the mid-1800s, when Louis Pasteur in Paris demonstrated using filters that actually it was some particulate material in the air that was required for molds to grow. And so rather than it just being noxious smells and gases and things, there was obviously something in the air which you could actually prevent with a filter. So they called these particles germs. And in 1877, Robert Koch in Berlin actually isolated the first germ or bacteria, and that was the cause of anthrax. This heralded the golden age of bacteriology, when more and more pathogenic microbes were isolated and discovered to be the cause of diseases. And so there was a big change then. And of course, now we can actually sequence the genomes of these things and know where they've come from and everything. But I think really in the late 1800s, this was a huge breakthrough, and very rapidly most people abandoned their miasma theory and believed in the germ theory for the production of infectious diseases.
Can you talk a bit about the history of smallpox inoculation, and is there any smallpox left in the world today?
Smallpox was unusual because despite most childhood infections becoming milder over the centuries, as I explained, due to genetic resistance developing within communities, smallpox epidemics increased in frequency and ferocity throughout the 19th century, continuing to kill around 30% of those it infected. And it's been estimated that it killed 300 million in the 20th century alone. So it certainly is the most lethal virus that we've known. So the first successful prevention method known was inoculation, so-called, which had been used in China and India for hundreds of years before it was popularized in Europe. It involved either taking dried scabs from a smallpox lesion and blowing them through a tube up a child's nose, or dipping a needle into the pus from a lesion and puncturing the skin on the upper arm or forehead several times. Now, that sounds quite an amazing thing to do, but I assume what it was doing was giving the child a very small dose of virus in the wrong place. So if you put it into the skin, it probably gives the body time to react to it before it sort of hits the blood and becomes generalized in the body. So these children would produce a few pox, so-called, a bit of a rash, and perhaps a fever, and then generally they would recover, and after that they would be immune for life. The technique was brought to Britain by Lady Mary Montagu in the 1920s. She'd suffered from smallpox, and her brother had died of it. And so when she heard about this... Oh, sorry, yes, I forgot to say. She travelled to Constantinople in Turkey, where her husband was the ambassador for England. And when she heard about this inoculation practice that was going on there, she was obviously interested in having her children inoculated. And she did that. And they were apparently immune to smallpox after that. So when she returned to the UK and a smallpox epidemic came along, she tried to encourage people to use this technique. Of course, people were pretty sceptical about it, and there was a lot of opposition from doctors and also from the church, who seemed to think that smallpox was what God had planned for you kind of thing, and who shouldn't do anything about it. But anyway, King George I finally gave his consent to his grandchildren, his granddaughters being inoculated, after it had been tested out on 6 condemned prisoners and several orphans from an orphanage. He said that his granddaughters could have it. And of course, this did popularise it. And the procedure was pretty widespread, really, until it was replaced by the safer vaccination pioneered by Edward Jenner. And that was brought in the early 1800s. And is still being used today. Now, you asked me the question, is there still smallpox around? And the answer is, as far as I know, yes, there is. When smallpox was eventually eradicated from the wild, 2 deposits of it were made, one in Russia and one in the US. And they were intending, I think, to keep it for about 10 years just to make sure that it didn't reappear in the wild and then to destroy these deposits. But in fact, they never have been destroyed. And since 9/11, they probably won't be destroyed because smallpox is one of the viruses which people reckon would be very good as a biological weapon. And therefore, it's reckoned that we ought to keep a deposit of smallpox in order to be able to make vaccine should it ever be necessary.
What are your personal thoughts on not completely destroying it?
Well, I mean, before there were issues about biological warfare, I thought it should be destroyed. But I agree. Well, I wonder actually whether it is really necessary to make vaccines from it, because we do have the sequence, the DNA sequence of the virus now. So imagine we could make a vaccine without it. But I think they feel that... I know they actually, the Americans vaccinated some troops when they were going into Iraq, I think, and they found that it had the vaccine that we use presently had an unacceptably high unacceptably high problems with it. Mm-hmm. And so I think they're probably working on making a new one. But yeah, I don't know really. I suppose it could possibly be useful in the future.
Okay.
The question is it safe? And that was obviously a question when Russia broke up. Nobody's quite sure whether it escaped to other places. You know, mm-hmm. Scientists took it with them when they went to other places. So there's always that doubt in people's minds.
What are the biggest microbial threats facing humankind today?
That's a difficult one. I think probably... multi-drug resistant microbes like malaria and TB, for example, and also pandemic flu is always on the horizon. If a flu emerges, which we're not expecting, and we don't have a vaccine to, then it always takes 4 to 6 months to make a vaccine, during which time, I mean, flu can spread around the world as it has in the past. A global spread of Ebola is another one, Lassa fever. But I actually think that a completely new emerging infection acquired from an animal source would pose a huge problem. And it's not unlikely. New viruses are emerging at the rate of about 1 a year at the moment. And, you know, like SARS, we've never expected or heard of, in fact, SARS. Never would we have thought that that kind of virus would cause such an outbreak. So something completely new would be a huge problem, mostly because with today's rapid travel, a virus could spread globally before it was ever recognized, you know, and it takes... as I said, a good 4 months to, you've got to isolate it, you've got to sequence it, and then you've got to start making a vaccine. SARS did exactly that. It reached 27 countries and infected about 8,000 people before it was finally controlled. So if you don't have a vaccine, you've got to go back to quarantine measures to control the spread, and that's exactly what they did with SARS. But they were lucky, because SARS is... it travels in quite heavy droplets from the throat, and therefore it doesn't travel that far. You know, had it been something like flu, goodness knows what would have happened. So that would be my bet, is that something completely unknown will emerge and we'll all be floundering about trying to get to grips with it. It's quite interesting, actually, because Bill Gates is very interested in epidemics and pandemics and very knowledgeable about them. And he has been trying to persuade governments that you know, they should be prepared for these unknown events. And he always makes the analogy with a war. You know, he says, if nobody waits until a war is on the horizon before making bombs and helicopters and recruiting an army and everything, they do it. And all countries, however poor, have these things to a certain degree anyway, ready, just in case. But when it comes down to epidemics and pandemics, that just isn't the thinking. You know, the money is not there to prepare yourself properly, and therefore what we do is wait and see what comes, and then start scrambling about trying to make things. And the last Ebola epidemic, you know, lasted for 2 years for exactly that reason. We knew Ebola, we knew it would come again, but nobody was prepared to put forward the money to actually have a vaccine ready on the shelf. So, sorry, that's my lecture for the day anyway, but I feel quite strongly about it, and so does Bill Gates. But so far, you know, that's just how it is.
What are the odds you think we'll see a major, major, like, super devastating pandemic within the next, I don't know, 20, 50 years?
Well, it would entirely depend what sort of, I say virus, but it might not be a virus, what sort it was, and particularly how it spreads. You know, HIV is devastating, and we never expected that to come. But HIV spreads so slowly because of its method of spread by sexual contact that, well, we haven't been able to control it, but and we haven't been able to make a vaccine. But it is a bit different from something like Ebola or flu, which infects you one day and kills you about, well, Ebola infects you one day and kills you about a week later. You know, you need something there and then to stop the thing spreading. And so, yes, I've gone off the point.
You're fine.
I don't know what it's going to be. And that's the point, isn't it, really?
Mm-hmm.
That you have to be ready for whatever hits us. And right there on day one.
Well, Dorothy, I've taken up a lot of your time today. My final question for you is, what are you working on now?
Well, yes, I'm not actually writing a book at the moment. Instead, I'm writing a science column for a local newspaper. The last book I wrote was on Ebola. I was out in Sierra Leone, you know, when the epidemic was going on, and I wrote a book about that. And whenever I finished a book, I say, right, I'm never writing another book. And my husband says, oh, yeah, well. But anyway, I'm in that phase right now. So I'm writing a column for the local newspaper, which I really enjoy. And maybe sometime I'll write another one, but not yet.
Well, I'd love to have you back on the show in the future. I want to thank you again for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it, and it was an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Take care.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Pleasure to talk to you.